Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University and author of the new book titled Erasing History, How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future, who talks about the threat Donald Trump poses to democracy in the 2024 election. Josh Rubner, a lecturer at Georgetown University's Justice and Peace Studies program, who examines escalating violence across the Middle East and how the war could impact the outcome of the U.S. presidential election. And Kate Sugarman, a family physician practicing in Washington, D.C., who explains why she's volunteering her time to knock on doors and get out the vote for Kamala Harris in the suburbs of Philadelphia. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Fighting in Sudan's bloody civil war continues as the Sudanese armed forces now battle the rebel rapid support forces for control of the capital city, Khartoum. The RSF controls most of central and western Sudan, including the war-ravaged Darfur region, while the government allied with the army is based in Port Sudan on the Red Sea coast. According to estimates by the United Nations, the war, which has raged since April 2023, has killed 20,000 people and internally displaced more than 10 million, including 2.4 million who fled to other countries. The conflict has left more than 25 million Sudanese, about half of the nation's population, in desperate need of food and health care. Peace initiatives in Sudan have repeatedly failed as rival regional powers, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and increasingly Iran, China, and Russia, have armed both sides in the conflict. The international community has faltered in its efforts to bring an end to the devastating civil war, which has been overshadowed by the conflicts in Ukraine and Gaza. In rolling out her presidential campaign, Vice President Kamala Harris has highlighted her career as a prosecutor, pledging to go after predatory lenders, bogus for-profit colleges, and corporate bad actors who abuse their clout in the marketplace. But the American Prospect reports that the vice president has had private meetings with CEOs from Visa and CVS Health, which raises red flags since both big corporations face government charges for exploiting consumers and small businesses. Both Visa and CVS are defendants in federal antitrust lawsuits accused of paying off rivals to maintain monopoly power and of jacking up insulin prices in particular, as well as drug prices for consumers more generally. Several of Harris's top aides have corporate ties, including Tony West, a legal advisor for Uber, and Karen Dunn, hired by Google to fight off antitrust charges filed by the Justice Department. One of Harris's major donors, Reid Hoffman, has called on her to fire Lina Khan, the Biden administration's anti-monopoly chair of the Federal Trade Commission, while Hoffman's business interests are under investigation by the FTC. These cases raise questions about how far a Harris administration would go to enforce antitrust and consumer protection laws, given the level of apparent conflicts by her major corporate funders. Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, is an immigration status created by the Obama administration in 2012 to give temporary protection from deportation to 600,000 children who were brought to the U.S. by undocumented parents. These youths, known as Dreamers, have been permitted to work and get an education in the U.S. It was hoped that Congress would eventually pass legislation to give these young people a path to citizenship, but that's never come to pass. Now, the fate of hundreds of thousands of undocumented youth could be in the hands of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans. one of the most conservative judicial jurisdictions in the U.S. On October 10th, a panel of judges from the Fifth Circuit Court heard arguments on the standing of Texas and eight other states that challenged the constitutionality of DACA in 2018. The court heard arguments from DACA's defenders, maintaining that recent Supreme Court rulings bolster their arguments that the state's lawsuit against DACA should be disqualified because they can't show they have been harmed by the program and thus lack standing to sue. However, the Fifth Circuit rules, the case will likely be decided by the conservative supermajority of justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Since Donald Trump entered politics 9 years ago, he's consistently used rhetoric and taken action during his 4 years as president that clearly reveals his racist and xenophobic beliefs. But in his current presidential election campaign, Trump has doubled down on his use of corrosive language while promising to carry out an openly fascist agenda if he should win the November 5th election. In addition to his pledge to deport 11 million immigrants, the former twice-impeached president, found guilty of 34 felonies and liable for sexual assault, talks about using the U.S. military to target his political enemies, take away the broadcast licenses of news media outlets he dislikes, while quoting Adolf Hitler, as he labels immigrants as vermin who are poisoning the blood of America. Trump, who's increasingly showing signs of cognitive decline, has also discussed suspending the Constitution as he vows to pardon the January 6 insurrectionists, whom he calls heroes and patriots. In Bob Woodward's new book, War, former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Mark Milley warns that Trump is a fascist to the core and the most dangerous person to this country. Your reporter spoke with Jason Stanley, the Jacob Rawaski Professor of Philosophy at Yale University and author of How Fascism Works. His newest book is titled Erasing History, How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. Here he talks about the threat Donald Trump and the Republican Party pose to democracy in the 2024 election and beyond.
Let's start with the mass deportation scheme, the idea of deporting 11 million people. Let's think of fascism as a culture, or any kind of authoritarianism, really, is a culture of turning people in, a culture of the neighbor turning their own neighbors in, a culture of in schools and universities of students turning their professors and teachers in for not being patriotic enough. So the goal here, whether explicit or tacit, is to transform our culture from a democratic culture of equal respect and freedom into one where people are turning each other in. Turning each other in whenever they think they can get an advantage, turning each other in just for fun. So we're going to have a massive police force that is ready and willing and able to have immigrants turned in, to have political opponents turned in, to have teachers and librarians turned in. And that cultural shift of knowing that you can make a phone call or fill out a form to turn in people living next to you, turn in people in your school, that will fundamentally and perhaps permanently change the political culture of the United States. So it is a radical shift. And trying to find 11 million people to put in large camps before they're deported, that's going to require a lot of turning people in too. So people will be used to that. In 2018, when I wrote my book, How Fascism Works, I pointed out this was fascist rhetoric. And what we've seen is a gradual normalization of this. Mm-hmm. I mean, this kind of talk would have been disqualifying in 2016. But Americans are now completely used to fascist talk about immigrants as vermin, about political opponents as traitors. And it's been normalized. And the next thing to be normalized is the practices that this kind of talk justifies, the practices of arresting political opponents, the practices of turning in your neighbor. Those are justified by this rhetoric. And I don't think you can have the rhetoric normalized without the practices that it justifies, the practices of concentration camps for immigrants, the practices of turning in teachers who aren't sufficiently patriotic, the practices of broadening the concept of obscenity so that librarians and teachers who have books on their shelves that represent LGBTQ relations or transgender identities as obscene and representing them as obscene and decadent. That is all a fascist culture. Now we've seen the rhetoric normalized. And the next thing we're going to see, as we already see in some of these southern states, is the practices normalized.
As you've been saying, Professor Stanley, Donald Trump is telling us exactly what he plans to do if elected. Will that give Republicans, those who may be a little hesitant, will that be a rationale for Republicans to burn the Constitution right along with Donald Trump, given that Trump will say the American people knew who I was, knew what I was going to do, and voted for it anyway to carry out these policies? Trump will look at this as a mandate. Even if he squeaks by in the Electoral College and he loses the popular vote, which is likely, by millions of votes.
As Ron DeSantis said when he won 51% of the vote in Florida, I won 51% of the vote, but 100% of the power. And I think it's a mistake just to focus on Trump, because as we see from these southern states, as we see from Project 2025, the Heritage Foundation, as we see from J.D. Vance, who has a very extremist perspective, a kind of Christian authoritarianism with brutal consequences for women. I think, you know, this is going to give certain agendas, you know, ultimate power. People say Trump has no ideology. I think that's wrong. I think Trump is a xenophobe. He hates non-white immigrants. That is his ideology. So he's going to get that as much as he wants. But there's going to be a whole agenda that is being empowered by folks like Vance, because Vance will be the leader in waiting. And that whole agenda is a Christian nationalist agenda. And if you want to see what that looks like, go to Oklahoma, where they said the Bible, every classroom has to have a Bible and every teacher has to teach out of the Bible, even math teachers. So that's the kind of agenda. That's not to say that's Donald Trump's agenda. It's to say that he's made a deal with that group of, frankly, anti-American people, because this is a secular liberal democracy. He's made a deal with them. You support me and I will, you know, I'll point J.D. Vance. He'll get your agenda done. And then we'll all go after non-white immigrants together. And we'll go after democracy. I mean, they already own the Supreme Court. Right. So, you know, once they fill the rest of the courts, game is sort of over.
That was Jason Stanley, the Jacob Rawski Professor of Philosophy at Yale University and author of the new book titled Erasing History, How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. Find more analysis and commentary on Trump's threat to democracy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After more than a year of indiscriminate bombing and a savage ground assault in Gaza that's now killed more than 42,000 Palestinians, mostly women and children, Israel reported on October 16th that its forces had killed Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar, architect of the October 7th terrorist attack that killed 1,200 Israelis and kidnapped 250 hostages. Responding to Sinwar's death, President Biden said there's now an opportunity for a hostage deal and an end to the Gaza war. But Israel is moving in a very different direction, as its military launched a third offensive in northern Gaza's Jabalia refugee camp, where more than 400 Palestinians have been killed and tens of thousands were displaced. At the same time, the IDF continues to bomb residential neighborhoods across Lebanon that it claims are Hezbollah strongholds, that's now killed more than 2,500, and attack United Nations peacekeepers in southern Lebanon, injuring 15 UN soldiers with white phosphorus munitions. The U.S., which already has some 43,000 troops in the Middle East, recently sent an additional 100 soldiers to Israel to operate the advanced THAAD anti-missile system. The U.S. anti-missile batteries were deployed in anticipation of a possible Iranian response to an expected Israeli reprisal attack following Tehran's October 1st launch of 180 missiles in retaliation for recent Israeli assassinations of Iran-allied leaders. Your reporter spoke with Josh Rubner, a lecturer at Georgetown University's Justice and Peace Studies program, who examines the escalating violence across the Middle East and how the war could impact the outcome of the U.S. presidential election.
I have a lot of major fears right now. It is a very dangerous and precarious time. The fact that you've had the U.S. Navy participate in hostilities with Israel to shoot down the incoming Iranian missiles, and the fact that you now have 100 U.S. armed personnel deployed to Israel on another anti-missile system clearly indicate that the Biden administration is willing and able and ready and has already engaged in hostilities on Israel's behalf. So certainly there's a huge worry that should this escalate into a full-out war between Iran and Israel, that the United States could get sucked into this fighting without Congress having authorized the use of military force. And without exaggeration, we're facing the potential for the United States to be engaged in yet another forever war in the Middle East, this time explicitly fighting on Israel's behalf. So that's one major concern I have. The other major concern I have right now pertains to the situation that faces the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who defied Israel's orders to leave their homes in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. And Israel very much seems to be implementing a campaign to try to starve them into leaving or to starve them into death. Hardly any food shipments have been let in recent weeks. All of the telecommunications to that portion of the Gaza Strip have been cut off, so we don't even know the extent of the atrocities that are being committed by Israel right now in this area. And many analysts believe that what Israel is doing right now in the northern part of the Gaza Strip is implementing what's called the General's Plan. And the General's Plan seeks to drive all Palestinians from that part of the Gaza Strip in order to create a buffer zone between the population of the Gaza Strip and Israel, and possibly serve as a site for Israel's recolonization of the Gaza Strip. So it's an extremely dangerous and precarious time. And of course, all of this also feeds into the electoral cycle here in the United States.
And Josh, I did want to ask you about the election. Michigan is one of those battleground states that is on a razor's edge in terms of who might win it. And Michigan is certainly critical for Vice President Kamala Harris's hopes to win the presidency. But of course, as many of our listeners are well aware, Michigan has a very large population of Arab Americans and Muslim Americans who are horrified by the Biden administration's policy in Gaza and towards Israel in general during this bloody conflict. What do you think we can expect out of Michigan? And I guess this is not really just a horse race question. It's also a question of Vice President Harris. And if she sent any even small signals to this critical demographic in Michigan, that if she is elected, she may choose her own policy toward Israel in the Middle East and not follow Biden's unconditional support for Israel, no matter how much blood is spilled.
This is very true that it's affecting the political calculus of Arab Americans in Michigan and in other states as well. But it also goes far beyond that. The base of the Democratic Party is outraged by what they see. They're outraged at this policy. And the fact that Vice President Kamala Harris is disregarding these sentiments is a huge strategic mistake. Look, the organization I work for, the Institute for Middle East Understanding Policy Project, we commissioned a poll a few months ago that asked the question, if the Democratic party candidate supports cutting off weapons to Israel, would you be more or less likely to vote for that candidate? And we polled voters in the three key swing states of Arizona, Georgia, and Pennsylvania. And we found in these three states, for every vote that Vice President Harris would lose if she took this position of ending weapons to Israel, she would gain between 5 and 7 votes for everyone she loses. So we've been trying to make the case that not only is ending weapons to Israel the moral thing to do, the legal thing to do, according to U.S. law, but it's also a winning electoral strategy. It's a winning electoral strategy that's being neglected. And should Vice President Kamala Harris lose this election, it's because she has refused doggedly to respond to these concerns of the base of the Democratic Party, which go far beyond just Arab American voting constituencies.
That was Josh Rubner, a lecturer at Georgetown University's Justice and Peace Studies program and author of the book Shattered Hopes, Obama's Failure to Broker Israeli-Palestinian Peace. Find more analysis and commentary on the escalating Middle East war by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. It's all hands on deck in Pennsylvania, which is one of the battleground states that will likely decide the winner of the 2024 presidential election. One of the groups canvassing there and in other swing states is Seed the Vote, which recruits volunteers from around the country to canvass for Democrats with the slogan Block and Build, meaning block Donald Trump from another term in the White House while building the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. Seed the Vote, partnering with the Hospitality Labor Union Unite Here, is canvassing neighborhoods in the Philadelphia suburbs. Volunteers there knock on the doors of registered Democrats, independents, and Republicans, urging them all to vote for Vice President Kamala Harris and defeat Trump and his Republican MAGA agenda. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spent 4 days in the Philly suburbs with Seed the Vote in mid-October. While there, she met and interviewed volunteer canvasser Kate Sugarman, a family physician practicing in Washington, D.C., who's knocking on doors in Philadelphia through Election Day, November 5th. Tuhus began by asking Dr. Sugarman why she's using up her vacation time to work on the election.
I'm using all my vacation days. I am just terrified of Trump coming back into office.
Do you have any concerns about her positions, but you think she's just, you know, we just have to stop Trump?
Right. So I am concerned. And, you know, I've been very active in the ceasefire movement for Gaza and now arms embargo, you know, to stop the bombs. You know, I'm very active in Jewish Voice for Peace. I'm very active. And if not now, you know, I had to think long and hard about volunteering for this campaign. What finally put my mind at rest is that I made myself a promise that if and when Kamala wins, I will, you know, continue to protest from day one. You know, there'll be no honeymoon. I will put her feet to the fire immediately. And I know that if Trump wins or steals the election, whatever, that, you know, we won't even have the luxury of protesting. You know, if and when she wins, I will be pressuring her immediately to, you know, for an arms embargo and for this genocide to stop.
I know you just started this time and you're going to be there for the, through the election, but you've done this before though, right?
Ever since 2016, I started canvassing because, again, of the horror of Trump. So I've canvassed a lot. I really like Seed the Vote. A, they're very well organized, but I really, really share their progressive values. So I learned about Seed the Vote because I volunteered for Summer Lee, because AIPAC was targeting her, in her re-election for Congress, Congresswoman Summer Lee from Pittsburgh. And so I really like the motto of Seed the Vote, which is block and build, block the fascist, block Trump from taking office, and build the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, and build the future that we want to see. So I really, really like the block and build, and that helps me kind of with my discomfort over things about Harris administration that I'm very upset about.
Anything you want to share about, any impressions you have about how it might go or the people you talk to?
It's been time extremely well spent. It's hard to believe, but there are in the city of Philadelphia, there are still undecided voters. And we were able to have conversations to move the needle. It's hard to imagine being in the ground zero of the United States of America and there are undecided people. But I spoke to a young man, maybe a 21-year-old man today. And I asked him who he was supporting or whatever. And he was like, nah. I don't do politics. He was a registered voter. And so, I asked him, what was important to him. And I'm hopeful that I was able to convince him to go out and vote for Kamala Harris. At the end of the day, I'm not quite sure what he said, but we were able to find issues of agreement that were important to him and why politics actually was important. And it was important for him to vote for Kamala. What's very exciting is that Philadelphia just started early voting. This is not something that has been traditionally happened in Pennsylvania. Some voters seemed really interested in that. So we were able to really promote early voting. Yeah. And one of my canvassing buddies, she spoke to somebody who was just completely undecided. And the canvasser said, well, what's important to you? Veterans benefits and mental health. Yet this voter was undecided. It's truly unbelievable. Yeah, between the early voting, undecided voters, this seems like time very well spent.
That was Kate Sugarman, a physician practicing in Washington, D.C., and a volunteer canvasser with Seed the Vote in the Philadelphia suburbs. Learn more about Seed the Vote and other groups working to get out the vote in this election by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts, KTWH in Two Harbors, Minnesota, KPOV in Bend, Oregon, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.